Against the Grain. In the mid-20th century, the U.S. government and private companies joined together to develop medical applications from the nuclear industry and its byproducts. I'm C.S. Song with Sasha Lilly. You'll hear from writer Ellen Leopold about the Cold War, cancer, and radiation experiments on unwitting patients in U.S. hospitals after these news headlines.
I'm John Hamilton with this news. Intelligence officials said pilotless U.S. drones fired 18 missiles into two compounds in Pakistan's North Waziristan region on the Afghan border today, and local residents said at least 10 people were killed. The latest drone attack was at least the 13th this month and was the heaviest ever in terms of the number of missiles fired. A Pakistani security official said the death toll could be far higher than the 10 initially reported and said fire was still raging where the missiles struck. Another official said two vehicles belonging to the militants were also destroyed in the strike on Datta Khel, a village 20 miles west of North Waziristan's main town of Miran Shah. The Obama administration dramatically stepped up drone attacks in Pakistan, prompting anger by Pakistani civilians and some government officials. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has announced a landmark study on how the military should lift its ban on gays and lesbians serving openly in the U.S. military. Gates said he supports President Obama's decision to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, despite considerable opposition. Democratic Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin said the current policy is harming the U.S. military.
Dozens of Arabic and Farsi linguists have been forced out of the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, at a time when our need to understand those languages has never been greater. Thousands of troops, 13,000 by one estimate, have been forced to leave the military under the current policy.
But the ranking Republican Senator John McCain warned that repealing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy could hurt unit cohesion.
Has this policy been ideal? No, it is not. But it has been effective. It has helped to balance a potentially disruptive tension between the desires of a minority and the broader interests of our all-volunteer force.
The year-long Pentagon study means Democratic lawmakers will not have to vote on the issue in this election year. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has suggested that Iran would release three jailed U.S. hikers in exchange for Iranians currently serving in American prisons. Ahmadinejad said in a television interview today that talks were underway about possibly exchanging the hikers for Iranians in the United States. Shane Bauer, Sarah Short, and Josh Fatal were hiking in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region in July when they accidentally crossed the border. Iranian officials have previously said they would be tried for espionage. Their families have denied the accusations. Ahmadinejad said there were Iranians serving time for years in U.S. prisons for no particular crime. Five young U.S. Muslim men say they've been subjected to electric shocks and other torture by the FBI and Pakistani police. The men tossed a tissue with some of the allegations scribbled on it to reporters as they headed to their latest closed hearing in court today. A judge delayed formally charging the suspects for at least two more weeks. Their defense lawyer Tariq Asad said one suspect told the judge that the police gave them electric shocks and warned them not to mention it. One of their supporters spoke to Al Jazeera English Television.
These boys came to the court and they told me that from the first day they have been extremely tortured by various authorities and they don't know why. They have not been told any of their crime. They have not been told what they have done.
A U.S. embassy spokesperson denied the torture allegations, as did Pakistani police. The five young Muslims from the Washington area were detained in Pakistan in December and accused of plotting terrorist attacks and seeking to join militants fighting U.S. troops in Afghanistan. A federal appeals court says the 22-year prison sentence is too lenient for Al-Qaeda-trained terrorist convicted of plotting to bomb Los Angeles International Airport at the turn of the millennium. A divided three-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals tossed out the sentence this morning and removed the Seattle trial judge from the case. A new federal judge has been assigned to resentence Ahmed Rassam. A lawyer says day laborers have sued a Southern California city over a ban on seeking work on the street. The ACLU of Southern California says the lawsuit alleging the ban violates the civil rights of workers was filed today against Costa Mesa in U.S. District Court. It's the latest in a series of lawsuits filed by day labor advocates against cities that limit workers' right to solicit employment on street corners. The lawsuit comes after Costa Mesa police posed as employers last year and arrested a dozen laborers. Day labor advocates say they've seen more U.S. citizens lining up at labor centers around the country because of the recession. News returns at 3:30 with Free Speech Radio News. More headlines at 4 o'clock. And please join us tonight at 6 p.m. for the hour-long edition of the evening news from Pacifica. Here's Against the Grain. Are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org with Sasha Lilly. I'm C.S. Song. We are constantly being exposed to radiation from our yearly dental x-rays and mammograms to the cell phones we glue to our heads, to our jobs if we're not lucky, and now to the so-called body scanners or x-rays that are being installed in airports around the country. Yet the regulation of radiation often seems little advanced from the mid-20th century heyday of its initial uses in medicine, as well as a weapon of mass destruction. The disturbing history of radiation therapy's genesis 60 years ago, directly promoted by a U.S. government keen to diminish fears of nuclear weaponry and fallout, is explored by Ellen Leopold in her book Under the Radar, Cancer and the Cold War, published by Rutgers University Press. She is also the author of A Darker Ribbon, a 20th century story of breast cancer, women, and their doctors. When Sasha Lilly spoke to Ellen Leopold last week, she began by asking what bearing the Cold War has on the way we see cancer today.
Say 1945 did have a phenomenal impact on the official response to cancer as a disease in the United States. And that really comes down at one level to looking at the source of radiation in the practice of medicine. So I was very curious to see where this technology came from. And essentially, I traced it back to the production of radioactive isotopes that were directly connected with the bomb project in the war. And these isotopes became available after the war and as a kind of way of making radioactive energy palatable to the American people, it was adopted for use in a lot of other civilian applications, including use in medicine, and most notably in the treatment of cancer. So the government in the late 40s and 50s was really in control of the direction of medical and technological research, and it directly promoted the use of radioactive isotopes in the development of radiotherapies, as well as in lots of other things. But radiotherapies that were adopted very quickly for use in the treatment of cancer. And the government underwrote the costs of this, and they paved the way for manufacturers to get the kind of technical support they needed to manufacture the machines. And they did everything they could to make this a goer. But they weren't particularly concerned with what doctors did with it after it was handed over to them. And so there's a very murky period there, which really hasn't been very well explored, that tries to look at how it is that this technology, which is so toxic as well as being so potentially, at least in some places, very beneficial, how it was that it managed to be adopted without the restraints that the FDA or any similar body that was controlling the introduction of new drugs would have put up to evaluate anything new that was going to be exposed to human patients. This never happened in the case of radiotherapies. So this is just one way in which I think this policy of that came about after the Second World War has influenced the way we treat cancer. And behind all of this was, of course, the need to test nuclear weapons, which the Cold War demanded. And so the government had to make atomic energy palatable to the American people. And this, as I just said, was a way of all these civilian applications of atomic energy were designed to show that here was a new source of energy that was going to produce positive things for the American citizen, and trying to promote the positive side of that while at the same time play down or distract attention away from the negative side of atomic energy, which was fallout, at least in the American imagination.
Well, let's talk about the Cold War itself, since that's the context for the argument that you're making in this book. The Cold War began in the late 1940s, following the uneasy ending of World War II, and lasted through to the 1980s. How do you understand the essential impetus of the Cold War?
Well, it was the fear that the Soviet Union was going to take over the world, and the world including the United States, and that it had the political power and the weaponry, including after 1949 when it detonated a hydrogen bomb, nuclear weaponry, to destroy capitalist society. The way the Americans presented this, I think, was horribly distorted, creating these so-called menace of communism, which has been explored very much more thoroughly in terms of the impact that the frenzy and the paranoia about communism had on American culture. So looking at films and cartoons and the literature has been a common pursuit by lots of people in the United States after the Cold War ended. But trying to chase down the more murkier impact of this fear of communism, fear of a power that was going to take over the world, has the impact of that on other aspects of American life have been much less well explored, and in particular the impact on disease, because as I discuss a bit in my book, there was a very early effort made to link communism itself with the idea of cancer as this rapacious creature stalking the landscape that was the ultimate destroyer. And so very early on you had this curious combination of an ideology which was a pro-capitalist at the same time as it was ferociously anti-Soviet, linking that up with a disease about which American culture knew very little at the time, but which had a terrifying impact on the American imagination. It really isn't so much the actual politics of the Cold War as they were practiced by the American government in its negotiations and refusal to negotiate with the Soviet Union that I'm interested in here. It was the way Cold War culture, which was guided by government and by the Atomic Energy Commission, the way that made demands on the United States citizen, so corralling his patriotism in a way that bred paranoia amongst us, because vigilance against the infiltration of the communist menace was something that was emphasized above everything else, and that vigilance then has this carryover sensation when applied to disease. So this sort of crossbreeding of disease imagery and politics was something that I thought really needed to be drawn out, because I don't think there's been any other time when there's been such an alliance that's been forged or forced down the throats of people as occurred in this period.
Well, tell us about some of those images and metaphors that the Cold War gave rise to as part of that culture of paranoia, obviously in very political terms, most associated with McCarthyism, but which, as you argue, also permeated the world of health and medicine.
Yes, well, it was this notion of a kind of inchoate monster that cancer was allied to, that was used to make this connection between a flesh-eating, totally fatal, toxic, soul-destroying, life-destroying thing, that cancer was summoned to play that role as a stand-in for communism. I mean, there have always been, the cancer its use in the political discourse did not start with the Cold War, because you can actually trace words like malignancy has been used. I think probably Shakespeare has used it a couple of places too, where malignant powers of government rely on this, use this metaphor. But it's never been done with an ideology that's so focused, and in this case focused on the Soviet Union, that this connection between this terrifying disease, which had the possibility of consuming you alive, eating you alive, for which there was no antidote, that once you were infected with a communist ideology, once you were affected with cancer, everything was over for you. You were going to be destroyed, totally destroyed. And now, if you read the newspaper today, I'm very sensitive to it, but I think not a day goes by when I don't read some metaphor that still uses cancer, metastasizing, tumors. In political context, terrorism is now referred to as, the cancer in our midst. It's still out there, but it doesn't have that tight link between just the Soviet Union and this one disease. It's been much more diluted now, but it's still out there.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Ellen Leopold. She's the author of Under the Radar, Cancer in the Cold War, published by Rutgers University Press, which we are discussing today. So, Ellen, in the mid-century period that we're discussing, what was the American public's sense of cancer in general? Was this a disease that had been becoming more prominent at that time? How did people think of cancer, setting aside for a moment the ideology of the Cold War that you've just been mentioning?
Well, I think they saw it as a killer without any qualification. And they also saw it as one disease. So they didn't discriminate between leukemias, breast cancer, liver cancer. They saw this as just this monster disease that got into your body somehow, took you over and killed you in rapid order. So they had very little understanding that it is really an enormous collection of diseases, and that even among subset of that, let's say breast cancer, there are hundreds of different kinds of breast cancers. There wasn't anything like that. And I think that the Cold War did exploit this sense that cancer was a monolithic phenomenon to engender fear, because it was something you couldn't get your hand around. You know, nobody really understood what it was, whether it was a virus, whether it was caused by something from another planet. They just didn't know what the cause was. There were very few, there were no cures, but there was very few evidence that there were ever going to be any cures. So it was just something that was immediately fatal and also extremely painful, that medicine had no way of coping with, and that in most cases doctors lied about. So many patients were never told in the 50s or even in the 60s and 70s, but especially in the 50s, patients and sometimes not even their families were told that their loved ones had this disease. It was terrifying. So it was this made it much easier for the government to manipulate the metaphor of cancer in relation to its anti-communist propaganda, because the public's understanding of it was so inadequate and so wrong in most cases. So it was very easy to take this metaphor and make seriously when it was used. And that was the hope that it would have the kind of terrifying effect that government propaganda intended it to have, which, of course, it couldn't have had if the public had been informed about the disease itself, but it wasn't.
And one of the things that characterizes this time, this culture around medicine, around cancer, was a paternalistic relationship between doctors and patients, which you write about in your book, Under the Radar. As sort of the moral center of your book is a Kansas housewife called Irma Natanson. Can you tell us who she was and what was her experience in navigating the medical establishment when she was diagnosed with breast cancer?
Yes, she was diagnosed in 1955 with breast cancer, and she was told that she could be one of the first people to undergo a new radiotherapy after she had had a mastectomy. And this radiotherapy was based on cobalt, which was one of the radioactive isotopes that had come out as a side product from the bomb project, from the Manhattan Project. So here we have this radioisotope doing its job out there in the civilian population. So she agreed to have this therapy because nobody told her anything about it. Nobody certainly told her that it was brand new and that she was probably only the 10th or 12th person in the United States to undergo this therapy. So within a week of her having a mastectomy, she underwent radiation therapy, and it destroyed her body. She was in unbelievable pain. She suffered terrible, terrible burns that did not heal themselves. She spent the next few years of her life going from one hospital to another, undergoing one series of plastic surgeries after another that took some of her dead ribs out. The ribs had died and were surrounded with necrotic tissue, so she had a totally sunken chest. She lost the use of her arm. They tried to restore that by doing surgery on it that deprived it of its blood supply, so her arm ended up being attached in some way to the side of her body but didn't have its own source of blood supply and remained there essentially useless for the rest of her life. And she then was accruing a great number of bills and extra expenses for spending a year or so in hospital. And so she decided that she was going to sue her doctor because he had never told her, he had never warned her of any of the risks that might be involved in this therapy, which, as I say, was brand new, but she really wasn't aware of that. So she went to court, brave woman that she was. She went to court, and that's how I know all the details about what happened to her, because it's in the transcript of her case. And she did win after she lost. She lost initially, but she took the case to appeal. She won. And it became a rather important case in the discussion of informed consent, because she had not been told anything in advance. But it did not have any impact on the way that radiation or radiotherapies would be regulated. And this is one of the things that I think is very important about this book, because the powers that be, the nuclear regulatory bodies that are responsible for the use and exposure of Americans to radiation have always refused or resisted interfering in the practice of medicine to set standards to inspect machines, to regulate the maximum dosages that could be used in radiation treatment. And I don't know if you've seen the stories that have appeared in the last couple of days in the New York Times.
I did see that. This is the case of a relatively young man who died from getting an overdose of radiation in treatment in a hospital.
He suffered terrible injuries, really horrific injuries, and eventually died at age 43. But there was another woman who was also in that story who had breast cancer. And she endured the same experience, the same overexposure to radiation as Irma Nathanson had done, but this is now 65 years later. And the ability to monitor the use of these machines and to have there be consequences for overexposures or for injuries that they cause is no further along than it was 65 years ago. And the interesting thing is that the bias, there was a very long article about all of this in the front page of the Times, and all of the stories concerned injuries and overexposures to people who had been given therapy using linear accelerators. And the thrust of this article was that it was the complexity of the accelerators and the complexity of the software that ran them that made this problem so hard to control. But you can see from my book that this is not a new story, and that 65 years ago, when there were no linear accelerators in use, and when most of the settings on these machines were done annually, they were already complex, but they complex enough to create problems. But it isn't that today's problems do not exist because of the complexity of the machinery, but because there's not been adequate infrastructure to deal with responsibility for administering these machines and for monitoring them and for carefully following through in every case. Oh, you know, and the training of the people who use them is obviously needs to be a lot more complicated today. But it isn't as though this phenomenon has just appeared on the scene with the appearance of these high-tech machines. It's there all along, and it's there because the medical establishment has always resisted any interference by these standard-setting bodies into the practice of medicine. And there has been no attempt to get around that. Except early in the 1990s, there was legislation passed that tried to regulate the radiation in mammography machines. And that's the 1992 Mammography Act. And so there are standards for those machines that have been set. But you've probably seen those articles that were a couple of months ago about all of the mammography machines that are malfunctioning and delivering unacceptably high levels, doses that maybe are 4 or 5 times the maximum recommended doses, and these in hospitals where this has not been properly monitored. I mean, I'm sure that the reporting of these accidents is just the tip of the iceberg, because there isn't, again, there's no mechanism in place to make it easy to do that, and there's no consequences that are regulated or that are have been promulgated that are fixed in stone. It's all on a case-by-case basis what the consequences are for any mishap, which are called, by the way, misadministrations.
That's the voice of Ellen Leopold. We'll take a short music break, and we'll return in a moment. Thank you. Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're discussing cancer, radiation, radiation therapy, and the Cold War, the complex and entwined history of cancer in this country, how we understand it, shaped very much through the prism of the Cold War. That's the argument that my guest makes. Her name is Ellen Leopold, and she is the author of Under the Radar, Cancer and the Cold War, published by Rutgers University Press, as well as A Darker Ribbon, a 20th century story of breast cancer, women, and their doctors. So before the break, Ellen, you were discussing the case of Irma Nathanson and the phenomenon of radiotherapy, of radiation being used as a treatment for cancer. And in the case of Irma Nathanson, the technology that she was an early and very unfortunate recipient of was cobalt radiation. Tell us about the rise of cobalt radiation.
This was the first application of cobalt to a medical use. And as I said, it was a spin-off from the Manhattan Project, the Cobalt 60, and was found to be something that was could be suitable in X-rays. Before they used cobalt, the sources of energy that were used for most X-rays was electricity. So this introduction of atomic energy into the provision of medicine was definitely something that was a post-war and Cold War phenomenon because it was exploiting compounds that had been made available for the first time in the reactors in Oak Ridge for civilian purposes. The way it was developed was through a partnership between radiation specialists at the MD Anderson Cancer Hospital in Houston, which had just set up its first radiation department in the late 40s. They worked in conjunction, in partnership with the government, to develop a machine that could be used in the standard treatment of cancer as an adjuvant therapy for most cancer treatments. So this was a combined development with the Air Force, MD Anderson, but using funds from the Atomic Energy Commission, because the AEC was also interested in experimenting with the use of atomic energy on people, on human beings, to discover what the human tolerance was for exposure to radiation. And they wanted to know that not because they were concerned about the civilian population, but because they wanted to know how best to deploy American military troops in a case where they had been exposed to an atomic bomb or somehow exposed to fallout from someone else's, some enemy bomb in the United States. They wanted to know how the American military was going to be able to cope with this, how long they could remain on the battlefield, that kind of thing, how dangerous it would be. But so that was the military's interest. The hospital's interest was in how to use this new source material to provide a therapy that would work with cancer patients. So right from the very beginning, there is this sort of conflicted or compound interest in how this technology was going to be developed. And in fact, the same machines that were used on the first patients at the MD Anderson Hospital were also used in some very shady secret experiments, which were also conducted at the MD Anderson Hospital on unsuspecting patients who were cancer patients, terminally ill cancer patients, who thought they were getting some new treatment. But they were instead being exposed to rather larger doses of radiation using these cobalt machines for the purposes of finding out what the impact would be on their cognitive abilities and on their ability to absorb and continue behaving, having absorbed so much radiation. So the same machines were delivering therapy to cancer patients who knew they had cancer and were being treated for cancer. But on the other hand, they were also being used to expose terminally ill cancer patients to much higher doses of radiation. And these people were clearly guinea pigs who had no idea that they were being used for this purpose. Medically, of course, it makes no sense to have done that because there was no way that terminally ill patients could provide information which would actually be useful or reliable to anybody for anything. But, I mean, it was unconscionable because they were not informed that they were participants in a government experiment which had nothing to do with curing them of disease, but was rather to provide information about human tolerance for radiation. But both of these things were happening in the same time and place in this one hospital and with government support. So you can see that at its birth, this kind of radiation therapy was compromised by an association with some really unsavory practices which the government not only supported and paid for, but worked very hard to keep secret. And all of these experiments were kept secret, more or less, with some exceptions, until President Clinton set up this committee in 1994-5 to look into them and to report on the extent and the scale of this kind of experiment that went on all over the country. And it turned out it was fairly universal, that even though many of the records have been destroyed, there were something like 4,000 experiments that used some kind of radioactive material in some kind of experiment with government support and unsuspecting victims. There was only a small minority of them that were cancer patients, but most of them were equally in the dark about what was happening to them, and most of them had never been approached for their consent, informed or otherwise.
So what was the awareness at the time of these experiments in the 1950s of the ill effects of radiation? Now, there were reports, presumably, of how Japanese survivors of the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were affected. And then, of course, the U.S. did tests in Nevada, which ended up affecting residents as those living downwind had fallout blow on them. What was the knowledge of the very dangerous effects of radiation and fallout?
Well, just leaving aside the public and their medical response first, we have to say that the government, which was in the best position to understand just how dangerous fallout could potentially be, did everything they possibly could to play down the impact of fallout or on the downwinders, as the people who lived downwind of the bomb tests were called in Nevada and Utah. Cancers started to appear very quickly after those various test runs started, but the people who were exposed, the downwinders who were exposed, had never been warned by any government agency to stay indoors, to cover their eyes, to take care of their livestock. Nothing had been done that would suggest to them that there was anything hazardous about exposure to the fallout of any of these bomb tests. So one of the first cases that came to the public's attention about all this did not have to do with people, but with the death of massive numbers of sheep. And since a lot of these farmers were sheep farmers, of course, this was their livelihood, and suddenly there were sheep that fell down dead and had turned blue. And in the case that the ranchers brought against the government, arguing that fallout had killed their sheep, they lost. They lost. They couldn't get the evidence together that would convince the government, who probably understood that the sheep had been killed by the bomb tests, but they were not in a position to marshal the kind of evidence that the government was willing to acknowledge. So then, over time, there were other cases that came forward, and individually, but then there was one rather large case that brought a group of plaintiffs together. I think there were a dozen, and there were half men, half women, and almost every cancer that had cropped up in larger than expected numbers was represented in one or another of the plaintiffs. So there were children, they were dead, but they were representing the leukemias that had grown in numbers. That was the disease which was picked up earliest because it affects children. It's most vulnerable to fall out than some others. But as for compensation for these cancers, did eventually include a lot of different cancers. But at the beginning, in the lawsuit, the Irene Allen lawsuit that was lodged in the late 70s, early 80s, that had 12 different representative cancers in it. And that suit came back after an enormous amount of evidence was given to the judge. It was not a jury case. It was a case tried before a judge who was seemed to be very wise guy and listened carefully, asked a lot of good questions, and mobilized people on both sides of the argument about fallout. In the end, they awarded damages to just a very few of the plaintiffs, and most of them were dead before they ever got any money. But down the road, with the compensation for the victims of the bombs in Japan, as time went on, more and more cancers started to appear, and more different kinds of cancers. So leukemia had been the first thing that cropped up, and then I believe breast cancer was the next thing that showed itself vulnerable to fallout. But as time went on, the government, the United States government, who published a list, who reported regularly on the findings, who followed up a huge cohort of survivors from the bombs in Japan, they started adding additional cancers, you know, liver cancer, lung cancer. And they finally, there was, after 30, 40 years of trying to get some justice for these victims, there was finally an extremely modest compensation plan which was set up, and which would award a modest amount of money, which is about $50,000, to people who could demonstrate their whereabouts, when, where, in relation to the bomb tests. And that program is still going. They're still receiving applications from people whose cancers are still emerging, and they haven't changed the compensation yet. But there have been a significant number of people who have received it. Now, this does not exclude the military. Veterans were made to appeal on their own, and the terms by which they were going to be eligible were also different. So, you know, there was a lot of divide and conquer here on the part of the government, which never openly acknowledged any responsibility or accepted the damage or the danger of radioactive fallout. And if you bought into this compensation plan program, that was going to be the end of it. That would disqualify you from bringing any legal action down the road. You took this money and that was it. They were buying your silence. Then there's another generation of people who were not exposed to the bomb tests, but were exposed to all sorts of radioactive materials in the nuclear industry, making nose cones for bombs, working with plutonium, mining plutonium. Their attempts to get compensation came in the 80s, not earlier, and has had mixed results. Working in a nuclear power plant, I guess the best known attempts to get compensation there were at Hanford in Washington State, which have been unsatisfactory for the most part.
Turning then to the use of radiation as a medical tool, so to speak. In the 1960s, there was a push to have women have mammograms, which was a different word for x-rays of their breasts, something that was pushed by the American Cancer Society and others. Tell us about the use of mammograms within the argument that you're making about the complex and convoluted and many times deadly use of radiation as medical tool.
Well, the first attempts to promote the large-scale use of mammography was reliant on machines which were producing radiation in huge quantities, probably hundreds of times what mammography machines now expose women to. And so the debate about mammography was as much about their safety in the 1970s as it was about their effectiveness. The debate shifted in the 90s into the when about the effectiveness of mammography rather than about its safety. These machines were not dedicated mammography units until the 80s. Before that, doctors or technicians were using x-ray machines, which had been designed for a million other things, but not for mammography per se. So you can imagine that trying to get women's breasts pressed up against the plates in order to get views of them was a much more complicated business and probably even less efficient, and even less visually efficient, I mean, than they have become since. So requiring more exposures and more intensive exposures. So there was a lot of pushback against this in the 70s because women were made to be quite afraid of mammographies because of the level of radiation that was involved. And this didn't go away right away, but it did encourage the industry, which is, after all, keen to sell as many of these machines as it possibly can. The threat of women not being compliant with their doctor's recommendation to go have these mammograms did reach the industry, which did figure out ways to add more filters, to reduce the increase the sensitivity of the film, to bring down the level of radiation that was required to take good images. That was a direct response to a threat of losing business. Today's situation is quite similar in that the newly released guidelines, which are suggesting that there is no substantial benefit for women to start screening at 40 rather than 50, does threaten the mammography industry significantly. I know someone who made a back-of-the-envelope calculation for how much it cost to save one life through mammography among women between the ages of 40 and 50. The estimate is that it takes 1,900 women having mammograms every year for 10 years to save one life in that age group. To save that one woman in 1900 has been crudely estimated that it cost about $3.5 billion. That would be the money that the mammography industry would have to forego if the guidelines were shifted from starting at age 40 to starting at age 50. But it is also true that scale of survival value, I would argue, is offset by the number of deaths that women still suffer as a result of exposure to mammography. Now, the industry is obviously doesn't do much research on this, and there isn't much research out there. But the estimate that I know of is that for every 100,000 women, something between 30 and 200 women will die as a result of their exposure to radiation in mammography. Now, that is probably significantly higher than the survival benefits that you read about in the paper from mammography for that same age group. I am talking in both cases about women, only about women between 40 and 49. So it's likely that more women will die from exposure to radiation through screening mammography than will be saved by exposure to mammography.
And that doesn't get to another question which has been raised recently, which is, do mammograms pick up small cancers which actually aren't going anywhere and therefore may lead to unnecessary treatments, including radiation therapy, which then have, you know, all sorts of traumas and consequences themselves?
We're only talking about diagnosis here. I mean, you're right that once you get in talking about therapy, all these other questions of overexposures come into play, like the stories that have been in the Times. And women who are having that therapy unnecessarily, we have no idea how many of them there are. None. No research looking into that, of course, because efficacy is not something that is being challenged. You know, it's always how do we add more treatment? How do we make treatment more intense? How do we make, you know, introduce more drugs to prevent more diseases? It's not about curing anything. It's about preventing anything. It's about treating, because treatment is what we know how to do best in a capitalist system. We can organize all of that best in the system we've got.
And that's one of the legacies that you point to as a legacy of the Cold War, that is private companies being involved in making profit off of these things, and yet the responsibility for cancer then redounds to the individual, that larger environmental occupational hazards are not taken into account, which leads to the question that, given the historical and perhaps present conflicts of interest of the government, of the medical establishment, of private companies in cancer therapy, so to speak, where should this leave us in terms of thinking about the use of radiation medically? Is this something that you think should be challenged across the board?
I do. I suggested in my book, not as something that I thought anybody was going to leap out and do immediately, but as something to think about, this notion that individuals should keep a track of their radiation exposures with something like a smart card, where every time they are asked to have x-rays at the dentist or they have a disease which requires heavy use of CT scans or heavy radiotherapy, they should...
Or going through the airport these days.
Or going through the airport. They need to be able to think about these things as being connected, because all of these exposures are cumulative. But the individuals who subject them to it, with the best will in the world, have no sense of this continuity, which is basically to do with human biology and human health. They are only interested in the chunk of radiation that they're involved with. So, you know, dentists are not concerned with how many times you have to go through the airport scanner, or whether you had lung cancer and had radiotherapy for that. That isn't their job. And it's amazing how hard it is to say no to routine tests. Just the way it used to be impossible to say no to having your annual chest x-ray, which was also absurdly overused, given that they only ever detected one case of TB for every 1,000 x-rays that they shot. But this smart card, this radiation audit idea, is really something to make people more aware of the multiplicity of exposures and the limitations of the organism experiencing these exposures. You know, that we are never asked to put all of these things together. And interestingly enough, the standard setting bodies for radiation exposures, which detail what they think, what their recommended maximum exposure is for everything, you know, from pregnant women to flights on airplanes, workers who work with radioactive materials, people who have radon in their house, they have an amazingly detailed list of what these exposures might be and recommendations for how much a typical American should be exposed to in a single year. They make no comment about any medical exposures. They will tell you what they think these exposures involve so that you can see that one, that a stomach series of CT scans involves about 100 times more radiation than a mammogram, but they do not ever attempt to interfere with what a doctor might recommend, so that their maximum recommendations for an all-in global figure of exposure for the year discounts. I mean, it gives you a figure, but it doesn't say you may have, you may, if you're sick or you have to have a disease diagnosed or treated for a disease, this is going to dwarf these recommendations considerably, because they don't even draw attention to it.
This has been a great discussion and very thought-provoking. I really appreciate you coming on the program.
Well, it's very nice of you to say so, and thanks for having me.
And that was a recent conversation Sasha Lilly had with Alan Leopold, author of Under the Radar, Cancer and the Cold War, published by Rutgers University Press, a link to which can be found on our website, againstthegrain.org. Leopold is also the author of A Darker Ribbon, a 20th century story of breast cancer, women, and their doctors. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670.